Before we get to the Jacob and Esau conflict particularly and the stealing of the birthright, I want to acquaint you or reacquaint you with one commentator in particular, and also the way that the Torah can be read through, through several lenses, but in particular through the one that she uses, which is a sort of combination of traditional commentary, modern psychoanalytic commentary, Kabbalah, lots of different stuff. And if you don't know her, she's not exactly easy to read, but that's okay, because I'll read her for you. But she's been at the synagogue. Her name is Aviva Zornberg. And her first book is called Genesis, The Beginning of Desire. The second book is, I think, called Exodus, The Something of Redemption. But she's very, what's that? Something like that. The Rapture, I don't remember. I have it upstairs. But she's not easy to read. But I remember when I first saw this book, when it was sent to me and I reviewed it for the, I think, the Jewish Spectator. It was several years ago. Anyway, I was really more than impressed with what she does with the biblical text. And she's become quite famous and is probably the best-known Torah teacher in Jerusalem now, which is kind of interesting because the previous best-known Torah teacher in Jerusalem was also a woman, Nechama Leibovitz, whose books are also very different from Aviva Zornberg's, but also tremendously important to study Torah. We've looked at some of Nechama Leibovitz's stuff before, and we will look at her again when we come to Jacob and Esau next time. But I want to talk for a second, before we get to Jacob and Esau, which we may or may not today, I want to talk for a second about a story that we've just looked at and how she reads it. Remember that the story we just saw was how Abraham sends Eliezer to his relatives, basically, to find Isaac a wife. And Rebecca, and Eliezer goes and he finds Rebecca by the well, and there's a series of negotiations and discussions, and finally she comes back, and we're told that she comforts Isaac for the loss of his mother. Okay? One of the problems with studying Torah, one of the good things about studying Torah, one of the hard things about studying Torah is you usually study Torah in fragments, that is, in little pieces, in sentences, in this week's Parsha, you know? And if you study this week's Parsha, and it's so interesting, when people ask me about the Torah class, they always ask me, are we studying the portion from this week, right? But you realize, now that you've studied in this class, that if you study the portion from this week, you really get a very superficial understanding of it, because what's an hour's study when we spend an hour on a sentence or two sentences? So what happens is that you lose sometimes a bigger picture, and when someone reminds you of a bigger picture, things click into place that don't always make sense without it. And already, I'm just taking a small section of what she wrote because it struck me as interesting and worth looking at. As she talks about Eliezer going to find Rebecca for Isaac, for Abraham's son, she titles this section the Akedah, the tragic residue. A residue is what's left over. Now, when we talked about Rebecca and Eliezer and Isaac, none of us really put it in the perspective of what happened with the Akedah, with the binding of Isaac. But after all, the binding of Isaac was the great traumatic incident that occurred to that family that had a lot of traumas, right? And you have to imagine that somehow, you know, you always, when your child picks a wife or your child picks a husband, you always think, why did they pick that person? What is there in their upbringing that led them to choose this person and not that person? And we thought about Rebecca choosing Isaac in some way, but why does Isaac choose Rebecca? And what does the Akedah mean in the background about Isaac's choosing Rebecca and Rebekah's choosing Isaac, and the way in which Rebekah, it says, comforts Isaac. So that's the broad outline. Let me read you a little bit of what she says. You'll also get a feeling for how she writes and why it's not so easy to read her and why it's much easier to have somebody just come and tell you what she says. The healing relation with Rebekah, who is and is not Sarah. So already, what does it mean, who is and is not Sarah? Well, you go to the footnote, footnote 42, where she says, see Rashi, Rashi being the classical commentator, to the tent, Sarah his mother. Literally, he brought her to the tent and she became Sarah his mother. That is, she became like Sarah his mother. For as long as Sarah was alive, there was a lamp lit from Shabbos Eve to Shabbos Eve and blessing and a cloud attached to the tent. When she died, they ceased. When Rebekah came, they returned. So she is Sarah, but she's not Sarah, right? But you have to go to the footnote to understand what she's talking about when she says Rebekah, who is and is not Sarah. So already you know that this is somebody that you can't read quickly, right? You can't breeze through. Contains the elements that go much beyond the universal Oedipal model. What's the universal Oedipal model? What is the Oedipal model? Right. You kill the father so you can marry your mother. Right. Now, first of all, as we remarked with Isaac, this was a case of the father trying to kill the kid, as opposed to the kid trying to kill the father. But you have to believe, according to Zornberg, that Isaac must have some hostility towards a father that brought him up to the mountain and held a knife above his neck, right? But he also clearly has a very powerful attachment to his mother, because it says he was comforted for the loss of his mother. Right? And not in every case would it say that. I mean, lots of characters in the Bible lose their mothers. Actually, I suppose every character in the Bible who lives long enough loses his or her mother. But this is the only time that I can think of where it says specifically he was comforted for the loss of his mother. So again, when Zornberg says it goes beyond the regular Oedipal model, you have to fill in a lot of background. But when you do, you realize what she's saying is very powerful. That there's more here than his just being attached to his mother. What's the more? The more is his attachment to his wife, to Rebekah, and the way in which she plays out what his parents did and didn't do. Wait, it gets better. does anybody know, she doesn't actually say this explicitly, but does anybody know in Kabbalistic teaching what quality Abraham represents? Chesed, thank you. Chesed means goodness or really love. Okay, when you say gemilut chasadim, it means deeds of loving kindness. So chesed can mean goodness, but it also can mean love. When she runs back and forth with the servants and the camels and so on, remember when she waters Eliezer's camels? If you didn't read this with us, just trust me. She runs back and forth and she helps with the camels. Who does she resemble? Abraham welcoming the angels. Remember when Abraham welcomes the angels and he immediately runs and says, Sarah, bake stuff and I'll bring stuff. So she's now making a connection in Isaac's mind between the Rebekah who runs back and forth to do stuff and the Abraham who runs back and forth to do stuff, which is why they're both chesed, they're both loving, right? For Isaac, withdrawn, now she's assuming Isaac is withdrawn, haunted by the shadows in his mother's tent, she will reinvoke the involvement of an Abraham, connecting, integrating, generating life. Okay? That's what Abraham is. I mean, Abraham is sort of the active principle. Abraham's always on the move. Abraham's always doing stuff. He's fighting wars. He's feeding angels. He's talking to God. He's trying to save Sodom, right? Abraham doesn't waste much time watching television, right? Abraham is always out there. Abraham is the kind of person who you say, you know, you don't have to go to Pittsburgh on business. You can stay home for a day, right? But he's already bought his tickets. And Rebekah is like that too. Rebekah is also, remember when her family tries to say, stay for a few days, what does she say? I'm going. Goodbye, right? And she goes off. So Zornberg brilliantly already has made a connection between Isaac, his mother, his father, and what he sees in Rebekah, which, as you can feel, is really very deep. That's why she's not easy to read, but when you read her, you get an awful lot. It's a very, very rich book. I remember this is from when I first read it. I mean, I've reread it since, but when I first read it, which is when it first came out, I actually got it in draft. I filled it with underlinings and comments and questions. The servant prays for success in his mission, but the word that recurs again in his prayer is chesed, love. She says three times in Eliezer's prayer, he says, act in chesed with my master. Through her, I'll know that you've acted with chesed with my master. And blessed be God of my master Abraham, who's not abandoned his chesed and his truth from my master. The importance of what Rebecca will mean to the family is intimated, that is hinted at here. For after all, there is a tragic residue of the Akedah in Abraham's family, right? The Akedah stays. The darkening of Sarah's light is one manifestation. But even in Abraham's case, what can it mean to him to undergo the test and then simply, silently have Isaac restored to him? It's significant that on Moriah comes an angel of God, and God says not a word to Abraham after the command to sacrifice his son. Right? That's the last thing that God ever says to Abraham is sacrifice your son, because it's the angel who tells Abraham not to do it, right? So if you think that that's deliberate, then there's a darkening in Abraham too. And Rebecca has come to heal the whole family, not just Isaac, but also Abraham, right? And it's shortly after that, how shortly after that Abraham dies is a question. So, she goes on about chesed for quite a while, and she says, the paradox of chesed, right? A paradox is something that is the opposite. It's two opposite things. Like, it's a paradox that in order to be successfully quiet, it takes a great deal of activity and energy, okay? Right? It's not easy to just sit there quietly, passively. It takes a lot of work. Think of meditation, right? You have to work a lot to learn how to not work. That's a paradox, okay? So she says, it's a paradox of chesed that it is gratuitous, free of necessity. In other words, you love somebody freely, right? Just like under the chuppah, you have to give the gift of a ring because you can't fall in love without giving a gift, right? That's what it means to fall in love, is you give this gift freely. But without it, everything fails. Even though it's a gift, the truth is it is a necessity, right? You can't live without chesed, but you're not allowed to demand it. That's a paradox, right? It just has to sort of fall into your lap. You can't say to somebody, you must love me because I need it. Right? A lot of people do that, but you can't actually evoke love that way, right? So here, Rebecca appears as exactly what Isaac needs, what Isaac couldn't survive without, but she's really a gift to him, right? He didn't say, go get me a Rebecca. She just appeared. And do you remember what Isaac was doing when Rebecca came along? Lasuach basadeh. He was wandering in the field, which the tradition says, by the way, is, anyone know?
Meditating.
Yeah, well, meditating or praying. That's where you get one of the fixed prayers of the day, right? Is the afternoon prayer is associated with Isaac's Lasuach Basadeh. Having done that then, all right, I'll leave that. The Kabbalah characterizes Jacob, born of the new balance being Rebekah is coming into Isaac's life, as emet, right? That's the quality that Jacob represents. As Abraham represents chesed, which means love, Jacob represents emet, which means truth. Right? And emet is also called balance because emet is three letters, right? Aleph, Mem, Taf. They happen to be the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet, the middle letter of the Hebrew alphabet, and the last letter of the Hebrew alphabet. Okay? So truth is balance and also all-inclusive. So Jacob, born of the new balance, is emet, perfect equilibrium. This is how Zornberg writes. Okay, I'm just going to read you the sentence, just so you should hear. The Kabbalah characterizes Jacob, born of the new balance, as emet, perfect equilibrium, consolidation of extreme modalities at a point where the center will hold. In reality, and in terms of the contingencies of narrative, this emet is mediated by intense moments of kmiat shelo, by the all-but sense of risk and accident that had proven so fatal to Sarah. Now, in English, what's that? Yeah, right. She uses a lot of modern theoretical terminology and jargon, right? She's a PhD in English literature from Cambridge University in England. She's English by origin, but she's also deeply Jewishly learned. So she will throw in a Jewish commentator and an English poet. The beginning of Desire comes from the poet Wallace Stevens. In fact, she has the I don't know how much of the quote she has at the beginning, but I will read you. She just says, not to have is the beginning of desire, right? That's where it comes from, all right? In other words, when you lack something, that's when you begin to want it, right? And that's how she sees the book of Genesis, as a lack and a wanting as a result of that. But anyway, what she's saying there is that all these different forces, there are two kinds of balance, right? There's the balance of nothing going on, and there's the balance of everything going on, right? All these different forces are playing on Jacob, and Jacob is the focal point and the balance of Rebekah and Isaac. The Akedah still lives in Jacob because it lives in his father. Right? So it goes on from generation to generation, that idea that, you know, things play out. Your grandparents' lives, your great-grandparents' lives have a profound effect on your children's lives. That's just the way. If you ask me what was the single most important fact in my life, it probably is that my grandparents and great-grandparents came to America. It's also the most important fact in my daughter's life, even though she never knew any of them. So those decisions, even though we may not think of them all the time, those decisions play out. And in Jacob's life, the fact that his grandfather took his father up to the mountain plays out in his life too. And that's why his mother had to be the kind of person she did to restore this active chesed to a family that was darkened by that event. Yeah?
I still don't understand. How come the anger is towards Abraham and not towards God?
For Isaac?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'll give you an example.
What's the question?
The question was, why is the anger towards Abraham and not towards God? Let me give you an example. When a couple comes to me and says, I'm Jewish, she's not, but we love each other and we're good people, we want you to marry us, which happens not infrequently, and I say to them, I really wish I could by your lights, but let me explain to you why I can't. And I go through Jewish history, and I go through what I understand to be the Jewish position and mitzvot and so on and so forth. When they leave the office, who are they angry at? Right. And it happens all the time. It just happened to be recently, in fact, with a Brit Milah that I couldn't be at because by my definition of Jewish, the child isn't Jewish. And the Brit is not going to be done in a way that would convert the child. But the parents are angry at me, which is, by the way, how I would feel, I'm sure, if I were in their shoes. I don't blame them for being angry. But they don't say, boy, I'm really angry at God because Rabbi Wolpe's not going to be here. They say, I'm angry at him. And Isaac the same way. Whatever God said, it was his father who lifted the knife. And just in human terms, it's very hard not to be upset, because not to be upset at the human decision to interpret God's word the way you do. So... yes, several. 1, 2, 3. Go ahead.
I suppose that Jacob feared that Isaac would do the same to him, or that Jacob's boy.
Oh, that's a good question.
That he would do that.
That's a good question. Both, whether Isaac would do it to him or whether he would do it, because he's more like his grandfather than his father's like his grandfather, right? So that's true. You know, Joseph Telushkin once said to me, a beautiful comment. He said, you know you love your spouse when you see qualities in your children that remind you of your spouse and you're happy. Isn't that a great, very smart thing to say? Very smart thing to say. Because how often do you say, oh no, you know, that's what your father does. But even if you say that, even if you don't like the quality, but it still brings a smile to your face as opposed to dread, then that's not a bad thing, you know? But so I'm sure that there, I mean, that's, once you start thinking of the families in the Bible as families, and you realize that the dynamics that were, I'm sure that Jacob thought, you know, is what happened to my father going to happen to me? Or is it going to happen to my kid? It's impossible not to think that way. My father's father died when he was 46. My father was 11. And years later, my father told me the 46th year of his life was the worst year of his life. He was terrified. He had four kids, all of us little, and he was sure he was going to die that year. He said, I know it's not rational. There was no reason to think so. They don't even know what his father died of. Probably a heart attack, but they're not sure because they didn't do autopsies at the time. And he just collapsed and died one day. So, so was Jacob afraid? I'll bet he was. What it means is an interesting question. Yeah.
Okay, so I had two points. Since you mentioned Freud, it seems that Isaac is really a person who fails to resolve the Oedipal complex. If I remember correctly, at a certain point, the boy is supposed to realize he can't kill his father.
Right.
And then identifies with the father. And it seems that
he never did.
Never comes to this point.
It's a good point. I don't know that he ever does. He buries him in the end, but it's not, he certainly doesn't resemble him in that kind of identity.
And the second thing is that it seems to me that Freud's idea of the child's fear of castration
mm-hmm.
is really linked both to the Akedah and circumcision.
Yeah. Okay, right. His father has taken the knife to him twice. That's a good point. Right. Again? You can imagine, right. Every time Abraham carved the turkey, Isaac probably got... that's a very good point that I actually hadn't... I mean, although the connection between the Akedah and circumcision is made, I hadn't thought about it in terms of Isaac's psychology, which...
And Freud's psychology.
Right. Which is, rather Freud's interpretation of what Isaac's psychology would be. I think that I have no doubt that it's also tied to this idea, which is a very powerful religious idea, of the idea of sacrifice in general, right? Which is what the circumcision is about, in part, is sacrifice in general. And the notion that faith demands that you give up what is most precious to you, to God, right? That's what, after all, the sacrifice of the firstborn is all about, is giving up what is most precious to you to God. And that's okay if you're the giver-upper, but what about if you're the sacrifice? I mean, it's not okay either way, but if you're the sacrifice, it's that much scarier, which is why, for example, I always tell parents not to say to kids, God loved grandpa so much that he called him back. Because what the child hears that as is, I better not be good, and God better not love me, because if I am, all right, that's what God does basically to people God likes is God kills them. So, yeah, Don, you were three. Right. It was not Isaac being the shadow, but that a shadow was in his mother's tent because of what happened to Isaac. So the way she put it is...
the sense of darkness.
Yes, the darkness, because according to the Midrash, Rebecca reignites the lights in the tent when... Yeah, Marcy. We don't know. We don't know that Isaac relayed the story of the Akedah, but family secrets tend to be intuited even if they're not expressed, right? Children feel like there was always something in my home that I didn't understand. So, I mean, there are all these Victorian novels, right, based on that, right? Finally, then they grow up and they discover that, you know, like Jane Eyre, there was a mad woman locked in the, you know, in the, if you've never read Jane Eyre, you really should, even though I've just ruined it for you. But it's a great novel. Seriously, it's a wonderful novel. And it would have been. And also people feel that, and it has an effect even if you don't know exactly what's going on. So, But we don't know for sure that that was, because I don't think the Akedah is mentioned again in the Torah. It's mentioned elsewhere, but I don't think in the five books it's mentioned anywhere. So, okay, so let me just a little bit more about what Zornberg has to say about Jacob. Let's see. Okay. His thoughts, okay, she's now talking about Isaac. The other moment of suspense occurs when Rebecca and Isaac first meet. The first moment of suspense that she's talking about is the moment when is Rebecca going to agree to be Isaac's wife when Eliezer prays, and is she going to show up and all of that. The second moment is when they meet. Isaac goes out walking. He sees Rebecca. Isaac walks in the shadows of the falling night. Again, shadows for him, right? His meditation is traditionally understood to be the prayer of the evening, the Ma'ariv prayer. For his thoughts, since the Akedah and Sarah's death, are locked in questions of transition, change, reversal, right? So think about this for a minute. There again is something that she says quickly, but if you unpack it, what has Isaac been thinking about, right? Sarah died, my father's getting older, I got to get married, all those questions of change. There are certain moments, you know, every year, right? When a kid has a birthday, you say, oh, you know, now you're however old you are and everything's changing and so on. But actually there are some that are significant. The year that they leave the house, right? The year that they get married. The year that a parent dies is a very, I mean, for any child is a big moment of transition, and it clearly is for Isaac. So those are what his thoughts are all about, is what's my life going to be now? Because he's kind of in limbo. The world that he's known is gone, and he hasn't created the world that he's going to create yet. And all of a sudden, Rebecca comes along. Rebecca sees him. How does she see him? This apparently is an important question, because the Midrash deals with it. Rashi says she saw him as majestic and was dumbfounded in his presence, right? Because what's the first thing that happens to her? She either falls off or climbs off the camel, right, and puts a veil over her face. The word used in the Midrash, toheh, for she was dumbfounded, recalls one dimension of that moment of confusion, doubt, and suspense. What Rebecca sees in Isaac is the anguish at the heart of his prayers, a remoteness from the sunlit world of chesed, right? She's all chesed. She's all goodness and love, and she comes and she sees this guy who's all shadows and darkness. A very different way of seeing the meeting between Isaac and Rebecca than any we've seen so far, but a very powerful way. And if you think about it, I don't want to say that this is a universal, bless you, female trait, but you know that it is a very common female trait to wish to rescue and save and change this depressed, brooding man, right? How many movies are based on that? These silent, brooding heroes, and they're so attractive because you know that you can be the person who will change, right? I'm sure that lots of people tried to change Isaac, but I can change Isaac, right? Wait till he tastes my, you know, Shabbos kugel. So too abruptly she receives the shock of his world. Who is that man? She asks, fascinated and alienated, right? All of a sudden she sees, hey, who is that guy? Because remember, it wasn't indicated that that was the man that she was going to marry. And presumably they saw a lot of people along the way. Why does she say, I want to know who this guy is? So the assumption that she's making is there was some air of Isaac, of sadness, of shadows, which is a very powerful thing, right? And when you see that around someone, you have one of two reactions. You're either drawn to them or you're repelled, right? You don't want to go near that, or the sadness is very seductive in a way. You want to know what makes this person so sad. What secret are they carrying around? She says, now this is, remember, why does Rebecca veil herself? This is Zornberg's reading of it. A fatal seepage of doubt and dread affects her so that she can no longer meet him in the full energy of her difference. She veils herself, obscures her light. He takes her and irradiates the darkness of his mother's tent. She is and is not like his mother. Through her, his sense of his mother's existence is healed. But the originating moment of their union, in other words, when they first met, is choreographed. It's set up in such a way that full dialogue will be impossible between them. they're too different. And not only that, but when they first meet, Rebecca veils herself from him. So, she says, they'll never be able to communicate fully. How do we know they never communicate fully? What's Zornberg basing this on? Right, she has to trick him. Instead of just saying, oh, by the way, forget Esau, go bless Isaac first, because he's really the right one, he should be the firstborn one, she has to trick him by putting, as we'll see next time probably, by putting hair on Isaac, getting Isaac to go to him. Why does she have to trick him? Because they can't communicate fully, right? How often do you, which sometimes happens, I mean, every couple does this in little ways, right? You want the person, you want the person to make sure that, let's take an example from, you want to make sure that I remember to tell my daughter to bring her backpack home, right? If my wife tells me every single day, please tell her to bring her backpack home, right? I'll say at some point, I'm not an idiot. You've told me this every day for the past year. I know to tell her to bring her backpack home. However, it's entirely possible that I actually won't remember, right? So now, what does the concerned spouse have to do? She has to figure out a way to tell me without telling me, right? She has to say something like, I really hope that she remembers to put her textbook in her backpack today, right? Something like that, okay? So every couple does that because you want things that you can't continually say. But about really important things like who should be the firstborn son, right? Who gets the blessing of the firstborn son? If you can't say that, it shows there's some block in the communication between the two of them. And she finds it at the moment of their meeting, which makes sense because I have asked many couples who've broken up, whatever it is that caused you to break up, was it something that was there at the beginning, or in fact, did it happen later? And except for some kind of sudden major life change, it is almost always the case that whatever the issue is, however it develops and changes later, because it always does, it existed at the beginning of the relationship, and either it was ignored or it was thought not as important or whatever the case may be. But so it makes sense when you look at a relationship to look at the first moments to figure out what it is. Milan Kundera has a really great passage about this somewhere where he says that, you know, you have to be extremely careful when you first meet in the first weeks you fall in love, because you may not know it, but you're setting the rules for the rest of your life, right? And people don't know that and don't. So that's why Zornberg, I think, is looking at the beginning and why she's saying at the very moment, I mean, that veil coming down is a suggestion that maybe the two of them weren't on the same wavelength. One was all light, one was all shadows.
And considering the rules, basically that's what happens at the end. With the veil, he's blind and he cannot see the shoe really is.
Yes.
And at the end, he's blind and he cannot see his son.
Very nice. Very nice connection, that the veil that Rebecca begins with at the beginning becomes Isaac's veil at the end, right? Because he can't see his son. He can't see his son two ways, right? He doesn't actually understand their nature, and he physically can't see them. So she closes the chapter like this. From this, deceptions, manipulations, maskings will result. A strange breeding ground for truth, right? It's very strange that from all these manipulations you get Jacob, who's supposed to be truth. But in this new marriage, a new metabolic balance, complex, containing its own seeds of failure and hope, is set up. The result is a condition in which twins struggled inside her. Both, right? Shadow and light, truth and lies, all of that struggled inside her. Enmeshed, entangled in her life, truth evolves from conflict and equivocation. So you see every good commentator brings a very different way of looking at the text. And even though I'm not going to spend a long time on him, I'll mention it more tomorrow, but when you turn to someone like Leon Cass, he's not concerned about dynamic balances the same way that Zornberg is. He's concerned about what everybody has learned. Isaac, he says, is the chosen transmitter, right? Isaac's the one who's going to pass on the tradition. And remember, how long between Isaac's prayer that Rebecca have a child and Rebecca's having a child? Anyone remember?
20 years.
How many years?
40 years.
It was 40, right? Wasn't it 40 years?
That, 40.
Right, 60 when she bore. Oh, good. I'm glad I didn't get that wrong. Isaac, as chosen transmitter, has been incubating silently for the gestational number of 40 years. Right? 40 is, as you know, right. Now he's going to learn whether he alone can be was born to carry forward and can be safely delivered and brought to life. Oh, no, you're right. It was 20 years. He's 40. I'm wrong. You're right. It was 60. 40, then 60. So it's 20 years. But he's 40 when he first says the prayer. At first glance, her pedigree is not promising because of what she comes from, but Rebecca's pregnancy is not the one. Well, then that goes on to the pregnancy. But let's see. Where's the section that I wanted to find? Okay. Here's the section. All right. You remember, she says to God, you know, Lama Zanech Nanochi, why do I exist? Because these two twins are causing her so much problems. And what does God say? There are two twins in your womb, two nations, and the older will serve the younger. Right? Does that answer why she has pain and why she's going through all this? No. What Cass says is that she's concerned, I don't remember exactly how he puts it, she's concerned with the physical, right? He says, birth order, the order given by nature, will be obvious but not decisive. What is decisive, what matters, will not be obvious. God hints that non-natural traits are more important. Rebecca wants to know about the natural strife within her. God's answer turns her away from nature in order to learn what the future may hold. In other words, what is God looking at? God's looking at who's going to get the blessing. What's Rebecca looking at? The pain that she's experiencing in childbirth, right? So what you get from these two different perspectives are, from Aviva Zornberg's perspective, it's all about the relationship between the two of them at the moment. And from Cass's perspective, it's all about God's designation of who's going to, yeah. That is a kind of answer, yes. It's like, you know, you remind me of, that's what the book of Job, which, you know, is all about why do human beings suffer and why is there evil? And at the end of the book of Job, God comes out of the whirlwind and he gives Job a long speech. And the speech is all about how you weren't there when I created the world. And you're not as powerful as I am. And you don't know why the stars are the way they are. And you don't know, if you tried to create the sea, you wouldn't be able to. And if you tried to play with the sea monster, you'd get destroyed. And commentators for thousands of years have been saying, you know, how is that an answer to the question that Job asked? And there are lots of different theories. Some I think are better than the one I'm about to give you, but the one I'm about to give you actually touches on what you said. Robert Gordas, a name that may be familiar to some of you, grandfather of Danny Gordas and father of David Gordas, all famous Jewish scholars. Robert Gordas wrote a book on Job, and he said, what God is saying to Job is what you just said God is saying to Rebecca, which is, look at this vast world. Your sufferings in this vast world are really very small. You've made them everything because they're about you. But the truth is that I, as God, see much, much more than you're seeing, and I want to show you this giant world in which your suffering is nothing compared to everything that the world is and needs to be. And Gordas says, how is that a comfort? Because it really is a comfort if you think about the fact that what you're enduring is not everything and global and gigantic, but that you're part of something much, much bigger, and this may be your part to play in something infinitely greater than your place. Now, you can like the answer or dislike the answer, think it's comforting or not think it's comforting, but that may be what God is saying to Rebecca, which is that there's a destiny playing through you, and it's not just about you, it's about something much bigger. So, yeah. Oh, sorry.
Zornberg doesn't make any inference to their age difference, it seems.
And she does.
It's pretty dramatic.
Yeah, you're right.
By, in and of itself, their communication.
That's, you know, it's like, it's almost as if I live my life to prepare for this class. Honest to God. Because every time you say something, it occurs to something that happened to me this past week. This past week, I was talking to a very young woman, very young here defined as about 20, okay? And she had been set up, not set up, it's a very complicated story, with a much older man, much older here being in his mid-30s, right? Not 60, but, you know, 15. So in other words, it was within like the broad category of this might still be a union that is societally, that's okay. It's not 30 years where you would say to a 20-year-old, you have to ask yourself, why would somebody who's 50 or 55 or 60 be interested in you? But still, she was asking, you know, is this too much of a stretch? And at some point she said to me, you know, as far as I'm concerned, it doesn't really matter how old you are, it's how old you feel or how old you act. And I thought to myself, you are 20. And that's a very appropriate attitude for someone who's 20. But as you get older, you realize that actually being older does, in fact, make a difference. And so the difference between being 60 and being 20, between Isaac and Rebecca, you're right, that could be the source of it right there. Because, you know, I mean, there are exceptional people, and people connect on all sorts of levels. And there are certainly marriages that have had vast age differences that have worked and been successful and happy and so on. But prima facie, which means at the very beginning, before you see that the marriage is successful, you have to ask yourself, what is there in this that might make it successful, as opposed to the assumption that there's too great a gap? Yes. Right.
And all there, and that Rebecca was trying to get away from. But my understanding is that that's the same family that Abraham and Sarah came from.
Yes.
And that's the total mishpacha with all the good and the bad in it from the beginning. And the whole story is differentiation of this new people. And my, also, the idea of birthright, my understanding is that from Mesopotamia, that their birthright was the youngest. And in the area of Canaan and in
oh, that I don't know. You may be right.
This is Sabana.
Yeah. That may in fact be the case, which would give a richer background to the
it's enormously rich because the influence of Sarah and Rebecca and them both being also very lighting the tent and bringing in certain spirituality, but also bringing from that tradition is about nations, fighting nations, and that would mean that the younger is
right.
That one tradition.
That I don't know. I'm looking to see if he has an excursus on birthright. It doesn't say anything, but I'll have to take a look at it.
It's fascinating when you look at it that way because it's two different cultures, and that is actually what happens a lot. I mean, it happens in your temple when you say, how do you treat the mother-in-law? The mother-in-law doesn't, you know, well, you have two different cultures.
Yes. More than two.
Don't we all?
Yeah, exactly. That's part of being in America. But I would say there are two, in terms of the family of origin, the question of birthright, that if you have the clash between the Mesopotamian culture, although whether there, I don't know what other culture plays in here, because they're all Mesopotamian at this point, right? I don't know where you get the older culture from, because he's going still. What's that? Yeah, but if that's still, the only other place that they're influenced by is Egypt, right? Egypt and Mesopotamia are the two cultures that influence Palestine. So I don't know enough to know where the two intersect, but I'll be interested to see what birthright stuff exists on the question of birthright in Mesopotamia. But I wanted to say something about what you said about the family. This is Abraham's family of origin. That's true. He comes from here and obviously leaves there. But it's also where he's going to, because this is where Jacob goes when he goes to Laban. And I think that our reading of Rebecca coming from Laban is influenced a lot by what happens later. Because we know that Laban is a no-goodnik, right? That he tries to cheat Jacob. And so you've got to assume that that Rebecca grew up in that atmosphere. We were also influenced by that reading last week from, I don't remember who made that connection. I'll think of it in a second, but who made the connection of the idea that Rebecca was fleeing there because she didn't like it, which was not explicit, in the Torah. Remember that what happens when you bring a lot of creative, interesting people to read the Torah is sometimes you get opposite readings, even though, like last time, you wouldn't say nobody read it as Rebecca is full of light and chesed and Isaac is full of darkness. But now that we've read that from Zornberg, it's a very powerful reading. And so it's hard to get that image out of your mind because it not only does it fit what we've read, but also, you know, our minds tend to work that way, that one person is light and one person is darkness. So it's a strong reading that way too. So we see Lavan's family as not a good family. And also, of course, Rebecca has learned from them to some extent because she tricks for a good reason, but it's still a trick. And then the question comes, are you allowed to do bad things for good reasons, which also was an issue this week, but yes.
So why, if she knew and she ran away from her brother, which by the way, I think you may have said was from Ellen Frankel.
Well, she doesn't do the whole reading, but she does part of it, yeah.
Why did she send her son back there? He could have gone anywhere. Why did she say he'd go back there?
That's a really good question. If she doesn't like her home, why does she send him back there? And I would guess, this is speculation, but my guess is that she probably feels like they may not treat him great, but he's going to be safe there. And if you send him out, your child, into the wide world, who knows? You know, you have relatives you like more and you like less, but would you trust them? Unless they're really, really awful, you would trust them more with your children than than strangers who have no. What's that?
The devil you know.
Exactly. Thank you. The devil you know. Right. Just so. Yeah.
Forgive me. I have a few basic questions.
Please. Why Isaac was what?
Monogamous.
Yes.
Considering that most of our fathers were in. And what if they had two daughters? What would have happened? The last thing I had in mind was last week, Arsha talked about Isaac and Esau. He said actually Esau was a good guy.
Just in the text. The rabbis don't say that. In the Torah, he doesn't do anything so terrible. Right. Okay, so
So what I'm saying is that one says something and everybody else follows?
No, it's not, I'll do as quickly as I can, I'll try to run through them. We think Isaac was monogamous because Isaac chose to be monogamous. He was a different personality from Abraham and because he managed to have the children that he wanted, which Abraham didn't with Sarah. So that's a guess. I don't know what would have happened if they'd had two daughters. Both children do get blessed, in fact, right? Esau does get a blessing. He just doesn't get the blessing of the firstborn. The blessing of the firstborn is the blessing of the majority of the property, and that was so that the family business would stay together. If you have a piece of land and every generation divides, in the end you'll get what Woody Allen has in Love and Death, right? He says, you know, I have a piece of land from my grandfather. This is my piece of land, right? So you have to actually, the Bechor, the firstborn blessing, is to keep the family property substantial. To the question of whether Esau was a good guy or not, the rabbis read the Torah in a certain way, and they read him as a bad guy for lots of reasons, in part because they want to make Jacob a good guy, because Jacob steals the blessing. All I'm saying is that if you read this without knowing any of the background, you wouldn't come to this and come away and say, oh my God, Esau's a terrible guy, right? You would come away and say, Esau got cheated, which is actually what happened. Now, Esau later comes to kill Jacob, which you might say is terrible, but in the end he doesn't do it. So even there, you can read it one of two ways. I don't know what the right reading of that is. What did I miss that you asked? Okay, all right. So next time we're going to talk about the twins, Jacob and Esau, and the stealing of the birthright. The stealing of the birthright is a huge issue. In fact, when I was looking for the excursus in the back here, whether he has one about birthright in general, he doesn't have one about the question of the birthright, but he does have one about called Jacob, the moral issue, about whether Jacob had a right to steal the birthright or not, whether Rebekah had a right to do it. That's part of what we're going to talk about last time. Now, here, what did I say last time? Here, the commentaries are very, very rich, because this is a story that everybody feels the need. Nobody skips over this story. Nobody says, well, there's nothing to say about, you know, okay, Jacob stole the birthright, let's move on. So you get very different perspectives, exactly what you were saying before, right? Some of them feel, but also remember that we have, one of the reasons that I said Esau was a good guy is we have a luxury that most Jewish communities for most of history didn't have, which is however they presented the people in the Bible, people around them were going to attack them for it, right? Remember that Christian polemics, and I'm sure Muslim polemics throughout history said, look at Jacob, who's Israel, he's a thief. That tells you the Jewish people are a thief. So naturally, Jewish commentators for generations tried to prove that what Jacob did was all right. God, in this blessed land, have the opportunity to interpret this any way we choose without it being dangerous to the Jewish community that we interpret it that way. But remember that for a long time that wasn't true. And so even now, traditional commentators, if you try to imply in a lot of, you can go to a lot of rabbis and a lot of Torah classes, if you ever imply that someone, one of the patriarchs, one of the matriarchs, did something that was wrong, they will not begin to accept that possibility, right? Because that's how the tradition generally, with some exceptions, the tradition generally said, partly because they believed it and partly because it was so dangerous for them to admit, when the whole world was attacking them, that their heroes weren't moral, for them to say, yeah, well, maybe this is true, that they're not moral, right? You see this, by the way, in nations too. You see it in nations all the time. When we do something if we did something to Britain, it wouldn't be hard to apologize, right? But do you remember when America, do you remember when it shot down the Iranian airliner? It was we clearly made a mistake. We shot down a civilian airliner, and yet I don't remember any kind of big formal public apology from America. Why? Because they saw Iran as their enemy, and therefore you don't apologize to your enemy even when you know you're wrong, because you don't want to give them that ammunition. So now, I'm not comparing, God forbid, shooting down an airliner to Jacob stealing the birthright, but you understand that even if someone had thought that was wrong, to say that was wrong would be a concession that I don't think they could make. But as I said, that's no longer true, and so I invite you next time to bring whatever you think about the birthright, and I'll bring a selection of commentators and let you know what they say. All right, thanks very much.